go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session May 17, 2012, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus the American Coal Company, docket numbers Lake 2007-139 et al. Present are myself, Commissioner Cohen, Commissioner Duffy, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Nakamura. Chairman Jordan is participating in these cases but was not able to be present at the meeting today. She has designated me to chair this meeting. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Rory Smith. Good morning, Rory.
Good morning. In these consolidated proceedings, American Coal Company seeks to have 13 safeguard notices declared facially invalid and to have 31 citations vacated. Administrative Law Judge Margaret Miller issued a decision concluding that the safeguards were facially valid and affirming the citations. The operator petitioned for review of the judge's decision, which the commission granted. American owns and operates the Galicia Underground Coal Mine, which is located in Saline County, Illinois. Between 1990 and 2006, the Galicia Mine was issued multiple safeguard notices by the Department of Labor, Mine Safety and Health Administration, pursuant to Section 314B of the Mine Act. These safeguards address transportation hazards involving mobile equipment, travel ways, conveyor belts, and hoist. Between 2007 and 2008, MSHA inspectors issued 45 citations for violations of the 13 safeguards at issue. American contested the citations issued for alleged violations of the safeguards. On May 6, 2010, American filed a motion for summary decision pursuant to Commission Procedural Rule 67, which addressed 24 citations alleging violations of 8 of the safeguards. American asserted that the safeguards at issue were invalid since they did not identify specific hazards and in some instances also did not identify the conduct required of the operator to remedy such hazards. American further stated that since the safeguards were invalid, the citations which were issued upon those safeguards were also invalid and must be vacated. On June 22, 2010, the Secretary filed a motion opposing summary decision and contending that the 8 safeguards provided sufficient information regarding both the hazard and method of abatement. The Secretary further argued that to the extent that a valid safeguard must describe with specificity the nature of the hazard, however, it is sufficient that the Secretary describe the type of hazard contemplated by the safeguard. On September 20, 2010, the judge issued an order denying respondent's motion for summary decision. She stated that a notice to provide safeguard is valid where a transportation hazard and the conduct required to remedy such are identified with necessary specificity. She continued reasoning that at the heart of this dispute is a disagreement as to what is meant by hazard. The respondent equates hazard with potential risks and outcomes that may occur as a result of conditions in a mine. The Secretary argues that a safeguard is valid when the type of hazard is identified. The judge concluded that the hazard contemplated in Section 314B refers to conditions and objects that could affect the safe transportation of men and materials. She further stated that while on occasion the Secretary chooses to include language in the safeguard which addresses the potential risks and outcomes associated with hazards, such inclusion is not necessary under Commission case law. The judge then concluded that each contested safeguard was valid on its face. On December 6, 2010, American filed a second motion for summary decision alleging that 5 additional safeguards covering 7 more citations were not validly issued. American alleged that these particular safeguards were invalid since they did not identify specific hazards and or they did not identify the conduct required of the operator to remedy such hazards and or they did not address hazards that are not covered by a mandatory standard. On December 27, 2010, the parties filed joint stipulations in which Americans stipulated that the conditions alleged in each contested citation constituted a violation of the cited safeguard. The parties also stipulated to the gravity, negligence, and civil penalty amount for each citation. In some instances, the gravity, negligence, or civil penalty amount differed from the original citation and proposed assessment. On January 4, 2011, the judge issued an order denying American's second motion for summary decision and affirming the challenge safeguards as valid on their face. The judge's rationale for denying summary decision mirrored her September 20th, 2010 order. On January 4th, 2011, the judge also issued a final decision affirming the citations in issue and modifying the gravity, negligence, or penalty amount as agreed by the parties. She stated that the stipulations allow for a final order to be issued so that the validity of the underlying safeguards can then be appealed. The judge incorporated the orders of September 20th, 2010 and January 4th, 2011 into her decision. American asserts the safeguards are invalid on their face because each fails to identify a specific hazard and some fail to specify the conduct required to comply. American seeks to distinguish the term hazard from a condition described in a mine. American contends that as a result of the alleged defects and other ambiguities in the language of each safeguard at issue, it lacks fair notice of how to comply. The operator also requests that the Commission create a presumption against the validity of safeguards that are of a generalized nature and not specific to Galicia. The Secretary contends that the safeguards are valid, as they identify with specificity the nature of the hazards and the conduct required by the operator to remedy those hazards. She asserts that a safeguard is valid when it identifies the hazardous condition at which it is directed. In addition, the Secretary states that the safeguards at issue provide adequate notice since they specify the means of compliance. Finally, the Secretary submits that because American never alleged or offered evidence that the safeguards were not specific to the mine, the Commission should not consider this issue on appeal. The Office of the General Counsel has flagged one safeguard in particular for discussion, safeguard number 7582396. This safeguard states, this is a notice to provide safeguard for all long wall units. The hydraulic manifold, hoses, and CIU shield control boxes shall be mounted in a manner to provide the maximum walkway clearance between the pan line cable tray rail and the shield components. In the event that the clearances cannot be maintained to provide safe travel in these areas for the miners, the conveyor belt shall be shut off and the electrical isolation switch at the head gate open before miners travel through the affected area. American argues, in part, that this safeguard is invalid on its face because it does not identify the problem that required a safeguard. The Secretary counters that the safeguard complies with all requirements and is valid on its face.
Thank you, Rory. Does anyone have any questions? We will now hear from Commissioner Young.
Thank you, Commissioner Thomas. And thank you, Rory, for your incisive decision on the memorandum. It was very helpful in our consideration, or my consideration, at least, in this case. More than 20 years ago, in Saco 2, a unanimous commission noted that as a matter of policy, perhaps the Secretary ought to consider taking some of the more routine problems and occurrences in the transport of miners and materials and moving them out of the category of issues that are managed by the safeguard program into a more permanent, durable, and widespread application through rulemaking, to ensure that all miners get the protections that could be afforded by this. And more than 20 years later, here we are, still dealing with the kind of ad hoc redress of problems that seem to be the same kind of common issues and problems that we see elsewhere in the Act, to the point where there's a faint echo of other cases we've considered here, where we've seen in escapeways problems being cited with water and obstructions and escapeways, and here we have a safeguards being issued to remove extraneous materials and water, and to address bottom irregularities so that people don't trip and fall. Similarly, you know, if you're on a surface and you have an equipment issue such as a blown headlight or a horn that doesn't function, there are standards to address that, and there aren't standards to address that underground. It's done through the safeguard program. This is something that Commissioner Dobby's expressed some frustration with previously, and I understand and frankly kind of agree with that frustration to the standpoint that that these are not exotic problems. They're problems that could occur routinely anywhere, in any mine, at any time. One of the reasons the safeguard program has a benefit is that it does allow you to look at the conditions in an individual mine, to take into account the conditions in that mine, and to provide the operator an opportunity to correct things that may not have been anticipated or foreseeable. But these problems, to me, don't fall into that category very well. Most of these are the kind of things that you could almost imagine your mom or dad saying, you know, clean up that mess, pour some more trips, close that door before you fall out. It's just the kind of thing that clearly ought to be part of a safety program. I think probably it's likely that most operators are reviewing their operations for these types of issues on a regular basis, but they may not be getting the prioritized treatment, and perhaps there's some validity there to considering whether there's enough going on in the underground mine that these types of things don't warrant priority treatment. But that's the sort of thing that comes up in a rulemaking discussion. When the parties and interested parties have an opportunity to bring their concerns to bear, and the policymakers can consider them. And absent that, what we have is the continued limping along of a program that just sweeps in kind of routine and regular problems, and not necessarily the sorts of things that need to be addressed via the flexibility that the safeguard provision of the Act provides. Having said all of that, I think that it's worth noting that summary decision is a very hard standard to reach. To find that under no set of circumstances that would reasonably arise from the material placed before the judge, that she would be able to uphold the validity of the safeguards. And having considered it through that lens, I think that it's very difficult to reach the standard where you find that these things are facially invalid. As the threshold matter in particular, I would hold that the argument concerning the non-specificity of the safeguards to the mine wasn't really raised before the judge, and there's no reason it couldn't have been, and therefore it isn't before us. But that does, the existence of that whole issue does bring back the whole panoply of problems that arise, where you're not necessarily looking at the mine for things that are unique to that mine, but for conditions that would occur in any mine. The fact that they can be addressed through the safeguard program doesn't necessarily mean that that's the most efficient way that they should. And I would hope the Secretary takes a look at this issue again, and I would hope our decision says something about that. Maybe that's something we do every 20 or 21 years. Back to the other threshold issue, I think the judge's interpretation of what hazard means is not erroneous. In fact, it makes sense to me, in particular in the cases before us, because in almost all of those cases, I think that when you're talking about the hazard, i.e., the alternative view of hazard, i.e., what might befall a miner who encounters these conditions, is fairly obvious from the circumstances expressed in the safeguard and the conditions described therein. And so I would affirm the way the judge viewed that. I would perhaps note, and I think we ought to consider noting, that in some cases that might not be sufficient. If you did have an unusual set of circumstances where the hazard to the miners, i.e., the problem that the risk to their safety that might be encountered, isn't evident from the description of the conditions, it would behoove the Secretary's agents to describe that in particularity, so that the operator does know what it needs to do to protect the miners from harm. And that's the point of this. Looking at the specific safeguards in this case, again, I think that they are generally fairly well described in terms of what the conditions were with the exception of the one that that Rory raised at the beginning, 7582396. And looking at that, there's no discussion as to what the clearance was, where it was narrow, how these things, these elements, poses, et cetera, could have been better placed to maximize the clearance, whether it was feasible to do that. I think that there's some justifiable frustration there in the fact that that it doesn't describe the conditions at all. And this has the air of a more general standard. And when you have the generality that the safeguard provision permits, where you're allowed to describe general things that might be done, and where at some point a fact finder, such as a commission judge or on review, us, takes a look at what needs to be done, the inspector's discretion and or abuse thereof could be considered. But in this case, when you have that generality in place and you don't have the specificity to back it up, I would agree with the operator. I don't see how you could know that you were complying and what you were doing without knowing exactly what the problem was. They might take some steps, and the inspector could come back and say, that's not enough. I don't think that's maximum. Without seeing the conditions in the mine, it's impossible for me to know. And if it's impossible for me to know, I don't know how it's possible for them to know. The other one that I was a little troubled by is just bottom irregularities. I think that was described well enough. It was kind of a close call for me because this is not it's not an unusual condition in the mine, and it's not something that's always especially easily controlled. And there's a pretty broad range of what might be considered irregular, and it's subject to the eye of the beholder. But I think that this, particularly at the summary judgment phase, I would find that the judge found sufficient descriptive clarity there, and I would affirm her on that and on all of the other safeguards with the exception of the one that I noted. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. We'll now hear from Commissioner Nakamura.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen, and I would also want to thank Rory for his help, particularly in the decisional memorandum and in having the patience to sit and talk to me about some of these issues. Preliminarily, I would also hold that we should not consider the operator's arguments that the safeguards were not based on specific conditions at the mine. Even if we were to consider it, there's no record on which to make this determination, since this was the decision was rendered on summary decision. And so I think I'm not sure the operator is really making that argument, advancing that argument seriously in the brief, but for purposes of I guess the decision, I would find that we should not consider that argument. And I think our precedent has historically treated safeguards that specify hazardous conditions and specify a remedy as validly issued safeguards. And so, in particular, if you look at Southern Ohio Coal Company case, which we refer to as SOCO 1, in which we held that the safeguard needed to specify the nature of the hazard. In that particular case, the safeguard described a condition and not the particular harm. So based on our cases, I would find that the judge interpreted the meaning of hazard with respect to Section 314B correctly. And that hazard refers to conditions in the mine. So I would uphold her with respect to her finding on the meaning of hazard with respect to Section 314B. I would note, though, that My view on that is restricted to Section 314B, because that's what this case involves. With respect to the individual safeguards, again, based on SACO 1 and subsequent precedent, I would find all of the safeguards valid except for the one mentioned by Rory, 75.882.396. As Commissioner Young pointed out, it is different from the others, and in that it doesn't specifically describe the condition the inspector found. With respect to the hydraulic manifolds and hoses and CIU shield boxes, and how they affected the walkway, so I think there's a problem with that one. And it seems to me the judge recognized that in her decision. She said that in a specific case, the secretary might have a difficult burden in showing that there was a violation of that particular safeguard. Finally, even though I find that all of these safeguards are valid, I would want to reiterate what SACO 1 did say, and that when these safeguards are applied to particular facts, they are to be narrowly construed. And we don't, in this particular case, we don't have any comparison to make, as argument of the company was to attack these, or strategy of the company was to attack these on their facial validity. But as applied, I think the judges must look at these and determine whether or not they provided adequate notice and specifically apply to the circumstances in a particular case. And again, I would reiterate the holding of SACO 1, that they are to be narrowly construed. Thank you.
Commissioner Duffy.
Thank you, Commissioner Cullen, and thank you, Rory, for your well-written and thorough DM. The legal analysis is especially helpful to me. I have little to add to my colleague's remarks, which I agree with. Thus, I also find that the Commission is foreclosed from entertaining Galatia's argument that these safeguards were invalid because they were not specific to the conditions in the Galatia mine. That argument was not raised appropriately before the judge and therefore cannot be entertained here on review. Likewise, I can accept the judge's definition of the term hazard as it is used in the context of Section 314B of the Mine Act. In short, the term hazard refers to the conditions observed by the inspector, not the risk or harm engendered by those conditions. Lastly, I would affirm the judge's conclusions that all the safeguards except number 75.882.396 were validly issued, and that the citations based on the dictates of those safeguards were validly issued. I conclude that safeguard 75.882.396 did not comport with the Commission's requirement in SACO 1, that a safeguard, quote, identify with specificity the nature of the hazard, close quote. This particular safeguard, unlike the others, specified the actions Galatia was required to take without adequately specifying why those actions were necessary. So I would vacate the safeguard and the citation that was issued on the basis of the safeguard. Notwithstanding my general agreement with my colleagues and with the judge, I must reiterate my concerns expressed in my dissent in Wolf Run. That is, there is no excuse for the Secretary's continued failure to afford underground coal miners the same level of protection against transportation hazards and their attendant injury than she currently affords surface coal miners and both surface and underground hard rock miners. As I stated in Wolf Run, safeguards were intended by Congress in the 1969 Coal Mine Health and Safety Act to serve as a stopgap measure to take effect until such time as mandatory standards applicable to the safe transport and passage of personnel and materials in underground coal mines could be promulgated through notice and comment rulemaking. Here we are 43 years later trying to decide whether a baker's dozen of safeguards issued by an individual mine inspectors provided adequate notice to this operator of the nature of the hazards the safeguards were meant to address and the means by which those hazards were to be addressed. Moreover, by reason of the process by which safeguards are issued, it is still possible that the requirement to provide a safeguard may not arise until a miner is killed or seriously injured, even while miners in an adjacent mine are protected by a safeguard that might have been issued years before by a more observant inspector or as a result of an earlier serious accident. Another concern I have with the safeguard process as presently utilized is that it places an extraordinary degree of discretionary authority and autonomy in the individual inspector, who, like all of us, is fallible. Unfortunately, at least in the early going, that discretion is unreviewable. Safeguards at their issuance cannot be challenged. Only subsequent citations for failure to maintain an underlying safeguard can be made subject to commission review. Then, and only then, can the validity of the safeguard be challenged. If that subsequent challenge is successful, the mine operator will already have invested resources into accommodating the inspector's erroneous view that the safeguard was appropriate. Unfortunately, in this case, the operator is precluded from advancing at least one fertile basis for challenging these particular safeguards and the subsequent citations issued for not maintaining the safeguards. But I would hope that other operators will come forward to challenge the safeguard process on the grounds that it does not appear to be utilized to address conditions unique to a particular mine, but rather is used to compensate for decades of regulatory lassitude by several administrations. Whether or not my colleagues care to join me, I do intend to address what I feel is a potentially tragic, lost opportunity to provide comprehensive and universal protection against transportation hazards to all miners subject to the Mine Act, including underground coal mines.
Thank you, Commissioner Duffy. And thank you, Rory, for a very thorough and thoughtful decisional memo. At the outset, I would note that American Coal's approach here is a facial challenge to these 13 safeguards. American Coal is not arguing that the citations based on the safeguards are invalid as applied, but rather that the safeguards themselves are facially invalid. According to American, the safeguards are so flawed that no set of circumstances at the mine, however dangerous, can justify a citation written on any one of them. Thus, American is not availing itself of the cautious approach articulated by Judge Miller in saying with regard to several of the safeguards that the Secretary's formulation of these safeguards has the effect of creating a more difficult standard of proof of a violation of the safeguard. For example, regarding safeguard number 4268263, the inspector noted in the safeguard that there was water and slurry conditions in excess of 16 inches in the number 4 belt drive travelway, which impeded a clear travelway of at least 24 inches. The safeguard required a clear travelway at least 24 inches wide on both sides of belt conveyors, which had to be kept free from water or slurry conditions that would affect safe travel of miners. In her September 20, 2010 order denying the operator's motion for summary decision, Judge Miller noted that if MSHA issued a citation for violation of this safeguard, it would have to prove that the water or slurry conditions were such that they actually affected the safe travel of miners. In its petition to the commission, American claimed that it was left to guess whether 15 inches of water was acceptable. By its facial approach to this case, American has waived the argument that a particular condition did not violate safeguard number 4268263 because, in fact, irrespective of the depth of the water or slurry, travel there was not unsafe. American can make such argument in a future case, but not in this case. Next, I reject American's argument in footnote 9 of its petition that the Commission ought to create a presumption that if MSHA promulgates safeguards common to a number of different mines, such safeguards are invalid because they are not based on specific conditions at the particular mine in question. This argument was not presented to the judge and must fail because of Section 113(d)(2)(iii) of the Mine Act. Additionally, as the Secretary pointed out, American did not allege or offer any evidence that these safeguards were not specific to the Galatia mine. Applicable to all of these safeguards, American argues that Judge Miller erred in her definition of the word hazard as used in Section 314B of the Act. American argues that a legally sufficient safeguard under the statute requires identification of the nature of the hazard as well as the hazardous condition. American argues that unless it is informed of the rationale for the hazard, it will not be able to defend against it or know what it must do to avoid a citation for violation of the safeguard. I would reject American's argument. In her decision, Judge Miller drew a distinction between hazards in the sense of conditions or objects in the mine and hazards in the sense of potential risks or outcomes associated with those conditions. I'm not sure, given the phrasing of American's challenge, limited as it is to reliance on the language-specific nature of the hazard as stated by the Commission in the first Sacco case, whether we have to actually reach the issue of whether Judge Miller's distinction between these two meanings of the word hazard and her view that hazard in the context of Section 314B refers only to a condition in the mine is valid. However, assuming that it is necessary to reach this issue, I think that Judge Miller did not err. The word hazard also appears in Section 104D1 of the Mine Act in defining significant and substantial. The Commission took this up in the National Gypsum case and noted that Webster's Third New International Dictionary contains several different definitions of hazard. One definition refers to risk or danger or peril, while another definition speaks of a thing or condition which is a possible source of peril or danger. National Gypsum also quoted Black's Law Dictionary, which refers to hazard as a danger or risk lurking in a situation. In consideration of these definitions, National Gypsum defined hazard in the context of S&S as, quote, a measure of danger to health, to safety or health, unquote. Judge Miller's definition of hazard in this case is a little different, focusing on the condition itself rather than the danger caused by the condition. However, we recognize that words are used differently in different contexts, and that National Gypsum's use of hazard was specifically stated to be in the context of Section 104D1. In the context of Section 314B, the decisional memo points out a line of Commission cases beginning with the first Southern Ohio case where the Commission has accepted safeguards as valid, where, as in this case, they describe hazardous conditions. Hence, I would reject the argument that Judge Miller erred in the way she defined hazard for purposes of Section 314B. American's principal argument is that the safeguards in this case were not sufficiently specific to provide it notice of what it must do to avoid citations for violations of the safeguards. I agree with my colleagues that 12 of the 13 citations in this case are clearly valid. The 13th, which I will discuss separately, is number 7582396. I do not agree with American that the other safeguards are so vague that it does not know how to comply with them. Indeed, I think that American carries this argument to rather absurd levels. I would again take safeguard number 4628263 as an example. This is the safeguard related to water and slurry conditions in the Belt Drive travelway. The inspector who issued the safeguard noted that there were water and slurry in excess of 16 inches deep and said that the operator must provide a travelway, quote, kept free from water and or slurry conditions that would affect safe travel of miners. Clearly, the key notion here is affect safe travel. But American's petition says that it needs to know if 15 inches of water would be acceptable. American asserts that the safeguard notice must be phrased in terms of the exact depth of the water rather than the safe travel of miners. On this basis, each case before the Commission on a citation for violation of the safeguard would turn on the precise measurement of the depth of the water rather than the safety rather than the safe travel of minors. And then, presumably, American would insist that the safeguard would also include the length of the water or slurry in the travel way. American could claim that it had not received adequate notice unless the safeguard also recorded that the water or slurry was at least 16 inches in depth for a distance of, let us say, 30 feet. And if the later situation turned out to be water extending only 28 feet, American would claim that there was no violation of the 30-foot safeguard. Then American could also insist on a measurement of the width of the water or slurry. The list of specifics which American could claim it needed to know for the safeguard to be valid is endless. The irony here is that the mining industry claims that government regulation is heavy-handed, yet here this operator insists that it cannot be held responsible for an unsafe travel way unless the safeguard is written like an engineering spec sheet. American also argues that this safeguard duplicates safeguard number 405-4826, which addresses rib rash, rock, grip ties, belt rollers, and other extraneous material in a belt conveyor travel way. American claims that because both safeguards address conditions in belt conveyor travel ways, they are both vague and arbitrary. But one safeguard addresses water and slurry conditions, that is, liquid, while the other addresses solid objects. The creation of both safeguards is essentially mandated by our decision in the first Southern Ohio case. Safeguard number 7582396 is different from the other 12. As the decisional memorandum points out, it does not describe the condition which the inspector observed, which led him to issue the safeguard. I think it fails the test of SOCO 1 because it does not identify with specificity the nature of the hazard at which it is directed. One might imply the hazard from the text of the safeguard, but under SOCO 1, the inspector issuing the safeguard is required to spell it out. Unlike the other 12 safeguards, this was not done in safeguard number 7582396. Finally, I agree with Commissioners Young and Duffy that these kinds of issues really ought to be included as clear mandatory regulations rather than safeguards. I agree, and it's distressing that underground coal miners do not receive as much protection as surface or hard rock miners do in the areas of their work which include traveling. I would think that if the Secretary were to go through regulations at 75.1403-2 through 11 and change all of the shoulds to shall, that would do a lot toward just creating mandatory standards that way. And if there were other areas that required additional standards, they could be added. But with my colleagues, I just don't understand why that hasn't been done. Before we adjourn, I would note that Chairman Jordan is not here, and she may have different views. She's going to participate in the ultimate decision here. But aside from her not having the opportunity to state her views, I want to check that OGC has everything needed to begin drafting an opinion.
I believe so.
Well, thank you. We will now go off the record.